First, I'd like to thank Leslie for inviting me to present this colloquium. The papers have been fascinating, and as was mentioned before, it's the second time I've made a presentation in Canada. The first time was for the workshop that Greta mentioned, held in 2008 in connection with the exhibition Synesthesia, Art, and the Mind, held at McMaster University in Hamilton. This is one of the Birchfield paintings that they selected. It was co-curated by Greta Berman, as well as Carol Steen, the synesthete and artist that she has mentioned, who's the co-founder and board member of the American Synesthesia Association. There's a picture of Carol with one of her paintings, as well as it's not the greatest light and reproduction of her alphabet. It's part mainly the slide, but the color of the alphabet as she sees it, it has a deeper richness and contrast that comes across in there. She tells a story about as a child learning that she was a synesthete without the terminology, just knowing that she was different than other kids, because she was walking down the street with a friend and she told this girl, "Your name is such a beautiful color, pink." And the girl said, "You know, you're strange." And so she, like many people, held back these declarations that she later learned were synesthesia and this special gift that she has. Since then, I've been involved in the organization of another exhibition about synesthesia that included Birchfield's artwork called Sensory Crossovers, Synesthesia in American Art, that was curated by the noted art historian and author Sharon Udall for the Albuquerque Museum in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And this is a slide of their intro gallery for the presentation that they premiered in 2010. And they gave Birchfield some of his own space in the exhibition. I unfortunately couldn't travel to New Mexico, so I only have their images of what the installation looked like there. But helped in advising which Birchfield works to include, and I'll show you some details of those later. One of my favorite other artists from that exhibition is Arthur Dove, and this particular painting, Foghorns, I think is a stupendous example of a synesthetic piece. It's really very modest in size, and it really resonates with that muffled sound. You're not quite sure where you are. He and his second wife actually lived on a houseboat. And so this proximity to the water and the foghorns and the grayness and of the fog, I think, is very, very beautiful. So then the exhibition traveled to Buffalo, to the Birchfield Penny Art Center, Buffalo State College, where I added more works by Charles Birchfield, as well as artists from the Western New York region, which is what we represent at our museum. This was our opening panel, and we used many, many different gallery spaces. We have a particular gallery, which is a rotunda. This, just as a little sidebar, is a round gallery because in 1964, Birchfield wrote in his journals that he would love to have a circular museum to show his season cycles and season transition paintings in. So when the architect, Charles Guathme of Guathme Siegel and Associates Architects, was designing the building, I gave him that little bit of information and it became a design concept for the building. So in the Birchfield Rotunda, I focused on the painting Song of the Marsh from 1951, which is owned by the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C. And in this, and I'll talk about a little later, we have the song of spring peepers from the marsh resonating up, as well as this red-winged blackbird, which has a beautiful mating call in the beginning of spring. So these are the first sounds that we hear with the seasons. Among our various related programs, we presented a panel discussion about the humanities, perception, and synesthesia called Exploring Synesthesia in American Art that was funded by the New York Council for the Humanities. I presented on Birchfield and moderated a panel, which included Sharon Udall, the exhibit curator, who's also known for her book and traveling exhibition on Emily Carr, Georgia O'Keeffe, and Frida Kahlo. And I understand recently in Vancouver there was a film made that was based on her research and book. Another presenter was Carol Steen. And from Buffalo State College, we had Jean DePiro and Stephanie Foraker, both from the psychology department, who are talking about the more scientific ways of measuring synesthesia and some timely experimentation, and Carol Townsend from the design department, as well as another synesthetic artist, Carrie Furman, who is completing her MFA at the University of Buffalo. And if you go on carriefurman.com on her website, you can actually click on these little icons and see these little short videos of how she sees certain sounds. You click on doorbell and you get this little ring, and then a certain color and shape goes across. It's really quite fascinating. Actually, I think synesthesia is a fascinating subject that has deservedly gained attention in the arts and sciences, fields that encourage its expression and study how it transpires. One of the clearest definitions began in Chrétien van Kampen's book, The Hidden Sense, Synesthesia in Art and Science, where he said, "How does it feel to hear music in color or to see someone's name in color? These are examples of synesthesia, a neurological phenomenon that occurs when a stimulus in one sense modality immediately evokes a sensation in another sense modality. Literally, synesthesia means to perceive together." Van Kampen discusses sound images and colors to introduce the concept of synesthetic correlations between sight and sound, probably the most common. Among others, he writes about color in music by composers such as Bach, Beethoven, Messiaen, and Ligeti, as well as musical paintings by artists Vincent van Gogh, the Blue Rider group from Germany, founded in 1911, Kandinsky, and Mondrian. He also shows examples of photography and painting by Marsha Smilak and Carol Steen in his book. And these accessible examples lead to more scientific texts and illustrations and charts from historic resources and current studies that utilize brain scans for evidence. Neurological evidence has been published by a number of authors, including Richard Sadovic, MD, who explains how neural impulses flow in a nonlinear path, and in a synesthetic brain, sensory stimuli can elicit more than one simultaneous response at different receptor points, which has been shown in CAT and MRI scans. And part of the wonderful conference that followed the exhibition and workshop where we were talking about the arts were international scientists presenting their findings a few years ago. And there's a lot of research being done at McMaster. Oh, I forgot to show you this. This was another painting that I showed in that rotunda with Birchfield Swamp Song. This is by a woman named Clyde Connell from around New Orleans area. And her painting, Night Swamp Song, which I think has interesting linear qualities to it, was done in 1970, so several decades later. I imagine many of you have heard of Daniel Tammet, a mathematical savant and functional autistic who on March 14th, 2004, set a European record by reciting from memory the value of pi to 22,514 decimal places without a mistake, by envisioning the digits as what he called a rolling numerical panorama of colors, shapes, and textures, taking 5 hours and 9 minutes. He literally sees numbers as different sizes and forms and colors. So this wonderful continuum was what he was able to memorize. He also learned Icelandic in a week and has performed in these kind of public displays of his special powers. From the arts perspective, the exhibition Visual Music, Synesthesia in Art and Music Since 1900 that Greta mentioned brilliantly illustrated a revolutionary idea that fine art should attain non-representational aspects of music. It was organized in 2005 for the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden and the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles. Museum directors Ned Rifkin and Jeremy Strict stated the groundbreaking status of their project. The first American exhibition of its kind, Visual Music charts the influence of synesthesia, that is the blending of the senses, and musical analogies on the development of visual art from the early 20th century to the present. Over the past 100 years, some of the most adventurous modern and contemporary artists have experimented with a wide array of novel techniques to invent a kinetic, non-representational art akin to pure instrument music. The operative word here is non-representational, as it aligns more closely with the description of synesthetes. The exhibition and its impressive book make compelling arguments in recognition of synesthetic art, illustrated by famous and lesser-known artists from several continents, as we have just learned. All the same, the synesthetic relationship between music and representational art also deserves attention. Therefore, consider the case of American watercolor master Charles Ephraim Birchfield, lived from 1893 to 1967. While it's impossible to declare with certainty that Birchfield was synesthetic because he can't be interviewed or tested, it is possible to examine what he painted and what he wrote that suggest a plausible sensitivity to synesthetic links between sound and visual elements such as color and pattern. Birchfield studied at the Cleveland School of Art from 1912 through 1916 with a concentration in design. He learned about the art of many cultures and became quite impressed by Chinese scroll painting and the Japanese prints of Hiroshige and Hokusai. In 1915, he declared, "Three great artistic men I love. I dream often of the possibility of a friendship with them were they living. They are Omar Khayyam, the poet, Wagner, the composer, and Hokusai, the artist." Several years later, he dismissed Wagner from that list. But at the time, as a student and hearing the music for the first time, he was quite excited. So in Cleveland, Birchfield's most influential teacher was Henry Keller. At the invitation of Walt Kuhn, Keller exhibited two oil paintings, including Wisdom and Destiny, which was considered daring for its day, believe it or not, in the historic Armory Show held in New York in 1913. The work of most Americans was overshadowed by the avant-garde work from overseas. The most famous painting of the exhibition was Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase, which was ridiculed by many American journalists, but it became an icon for the new direction of art. After attending this international exhibition of modern art, Keller returned to Cleveland, enthusiastic about the modernist works he had seen, such as Kandinsky's abstract and non-objective compositions. Keller encouraged his students to challenge tradition and experiment. One of those most affected was Birchfield, who in 1915 wrote, "Keller compared Americans and Europeans as to their freedom of expression. He characterized Americans as being afraid of themselves, which is literally true." Birchfield called 1917 his golden year, to acknowledge a radical stylistic shift that resulted in a newly achieved inventiveness and productivity. He created a personal visual language of symbols that would provide forms he adapted for use throughout his career. He also created specific patterns for distinctive sounds of insects and birds, and he gave human characteristics to inanimate objects. By incorporating a symbolic vocabulary, Birchfield was better able to express hidden emotions, and he could transform observations into empathetic expressions. So on your left, you see yellow afterglow, which is literally a view down the alley next to his house. His house is that gold one, looking toward this sulfurous sky, not very far away from his hometown in Salem was coke ovens. And the sulfur probably was making what looks to us this beautiful sunlit sky probably was toxic. On the right is the Salem bedroom studio painted in February 1917. And so this is just after he's graduated from the Cleveland School of Art. And he is, you'll see in a few moments, the sources for some of his conventions. Take special note of the clothes over the back of a chair, the porcelain doorknobs on the closet door, and even the shapes of these clothes that are hanging on hooks. Throughout his life, the artist also credited the significance of music and natural sounds, such as wind and vibrations of telegraph wires, to his ability to provide additional layers of meaning to large paintings that conveyed vivid memories. Among Birchfield's most extraordinary symbols are his conventions for abstract thoughts, created in 1917. These seminal drawings symbolize undesirable human characteristics and emotions, such as aimless brooding. Here you see it as if, you know, that used with these trees, the negative space between branches, but it's also very similar to those clothes that were hanging in the closet. There's the fear of loneliness, where this odd shape is very much like the hem of the curtains in this scene from his home with his mother sitting in the parlor. There's menace and fascination of evil. And then this great group of them, fear, morbidness, think of those clothes on the chair, melancholy, and the memory of things that are long forgotten, imbecility, insanity. You can see there's nothing very pleasant. I've written about these interesting conventions several times, including the essay that was published in Heat Waves in a Swamp, the paintings of Charles Birchfield, published in 2009 with a traveling exhibition that was curated by the contemporary artist Robert Gober for the Hammer Museum at UCLA in collaboration with the Birchfield Penny Arts Center. A few of the conventions were untitled, but most of them associate a particular shape with a psychological mood, thereby manifesting a visual image with an intangible equivalent. John I. H. Bauer, who became the director of the Whitney Museum of American Art, was the first to publish some of Birchfield's Conventions for Abstract Thoughts in his 1982 monograph, The Inlander, that accompanied the Metropolitan Museum of Art's retrospective on Birchfield in 1984. He illustrated eight of the conventions with an analysis of how they became the building blocks for a painting called Church Bells Ringing Rainy Winter Night. And here you see some of the studies for especially the bell tower where evil is literally this bell ringing. And here's the final painting, as well as a postcard of what the church actually looked like. And this was done in December 1917, so that painting of the Salem Bedroom Studio from February, you see the antecedents for this painting, which really merges the most of these conventions in any one place. It's a child's nightmare of a church bell tower filled with fear and imbecility, a conspiring sky swirling with fear, and below the peaked form of houses and doors is morbidness, while the smiling mouth of fascination of evil is emblazoned high on the right wall. An untitled convention that clearly evokes fear, we see Hokusai again, can be compared to Hokusai's Great Wave. And this comparison, I have to give credit to an assistant of mine, Tullis Johnson, who suggested that there might be a parallel, and I completely agree. And we know that he knew Hokusai's work so well that it's quite likely that that was the origin of this particular untitled representation of fear. This is another untitled fear that is shown with a painting toward the tail end of when he was using these conventions, 1918. This is the Night Wind. It's literally a little cottage next door to his home that had this tall chimney, and there was a widowed mother and some young boys living there, and that this howling blizzard in January, February, and that the frightful scenes, shapes that he sees in the middle of the night. And one of the last ones from 1918 is The East Wind. These are the last expressive works before Birchfield was drafted into the army in World War I. He never went overseas, luckily. He actually went AWOL for about a week, but he got away with it because it was the end of the war. Art historians Charles Eldridge and Sherry Cohn both thought Birchfield may have been inspired by the theosophists Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbeater, who in their book Thought Forms, published in 1901, described and illustrated auras with specific positive and negative meanings, including radiating affection, the response to devotion, sympathy and love for all, murderous rage, sustained anger, watchful and angry jealousy, sudden fright, and even W for the music of Wagner. However, there is no documentary evidence to support that Birchfield knew about their work. They were less likely to have been an influence than Sigmund Freud, whose groundbreaking book, The Interpretation of Dreams, was first published in 1900. But Birchfield never mentioned Freud either, but he did like to recount his dreams. And he occasionally mentioned trying to tap his subconscious, a term popularly mutated from Freud's theory of the unconscious. One must also keep in mind that synesthetes do not agree on specific symbolic color and form equivalencies in the way that Besant and Leadbeater dictated. Each highly subjective synesthetic experience yields a different spectrum for letters or numbers or musical notes, making it rather difficult to explain scientifically. During his period of uninhibited experimentation in 1907, Birchfield also recorded natural sounds with visual motifs that I call audio cryptograms. Operating independently, Birchfield was inspired by the music of the power of classical music and the organic sounds of the world that surrounded him. His predilection for interpreting music in visual terms surfaced as early as 1915, as you can see here in what he called abstract hieroglyphics for Wagner's operas. In addition to rapidly sketching impressions during concerts, the young artist became lost between the realms of music and art, writing one time in his journal, "This morning at work, a portion of Wagner's Love, Death from Tristan and Isolde commenced to sing itself in my head. I lost all consciousness of where I was. Gradually, it dissolved itself into a different and unheard-of melody that was the embodiment of my passionate longing for solitude. I yearned to compose some music when all at once I realized my work, which was to be a composer of colors with rhythms, which would compensate for my inability to compose sound with rhythm." Here's another one with the Ride of the Valkyries. Here's where I was going to plug in the sound bite, but I'm sure you're all familiar with the Ride of the Valkyries, and I wasn't up to speed with the technology for it. And the Siegfried funeral march, which you notice he has notations even about bright colors. So even though this is just a little pencil sketch, he's seeing and trying to record for himself some record of the colors that he's seeing with these hieroglyphs. For comparison, from the Sensory Crossovers exhibition, here's another artist's conception of Wagner, painted decades after Birchfield did. And I think kind of curiously, it's a little like the Theosophist idea for Wagner, but maybe there's a little bit of Munch in there with the reflection on water. Who knows, when you want to see a kind of castle in the sky. At any rate, in 1917, Birchfield's sonic animation relies on the repetition and devolution of forms to signify pitch, rhythm, and trailing phrases. Hieroglyphic shapes of birds, often echoed in cloud forms, suggest their characteristic voices. And his abstract motifs in insect fantasies transform one sense impression in terms of another. The insect chorus, painted specifically, wrote on the back, September 5th, 1917, is one of the most complex examples of his visualization of nature's cacophony mixed with some of his conventions for abstract thoughts. Huge black swirls of fear suggest a cicada's head hidden in the shrubbery. Beneath it, blank staring eyes, a shaded triangular alcove signifies the end of summer as melancholy meditation, memory of pleasant things that are gone forever. In the foreground, a high, shrill, pinpoint cricket chorus, as he called it, dominates the lawn. The cluster of chevrons across the bottom of the painting represents house or field crickets. So note how each one has its particular shape. In the foliage on the left, winged forms are tree crickets or katydids, and the trills radiating off the tree's top leaves are likely cicadas. The three-lobed mitten-like leaves of a sassafras tree echo morbid brooding in the upper right, and each distinctive sound has its coordinating audio cryptogram with patterns repeated to represent a segment of time or a number of active insects. The song of a katydids on an August morning transforms a neighbor's home diagonally across the street from his into this wonderful twittering sound, although he did admit much later that he never should have named it this, because katydids we hear at night and we don't hear during the day. But he left the title the way it was originally imagined. Childhood's Garden combines audio cryptograms with conventions for abstract thoughts in the billowing clouds and sad flowers. The little study on the left, Nostalgia, you can see how he decided not to have a distinctive character. This could have been a grandmother or an aunt who had passed away, and he decided to make it much more of a mysterious growth of ivy or whatever, which is much more reminiscent of some kind of a monster. And the little Johnny jump-ups are all squinting and wincing and sad, and this is probably the family home. They actually moved to Salem, Ohio when he was 5 years old, when his father died very suddenly. And so his mother had moved the family with six kids back to her hometown in Salem, Ohio. So that's part of what this is about. In fact, I think these little Johnny Jump Ups are meant to represent the children in the family who are mourning their loss. And here are some of the conventions for abstract thoughts that were in that painting. And an even more melancholy and frightening version of that painting is represented in The August North. I won't go into it today, but the sense of North and its mystery was something that really fascinated him his entire life. It became this spiritual, unattainable place that provided much pleasure. After service in the U.S. Army during World War I and an honorable discharge in January 1919, Birchfield ceased to create such vividly symbolic work. In the 1920s, he used more gouache. This Sleet Storm painting is actually a view right from his front parlor window across the street. And it's a little flatter and more architectonic. The paintings are getting a little larger in scale. In 1921, he moved to Buffalo, New York, and began working at the M.H. Burge & Sons Company designing wallpapers. This is one of his more fantastic views called Redbirds and Beech Trees from 1924. He resigned in 1929, just before the stock market crashed, so he didn't quite know what he was getting into. He had to support a family of five children and a wife. But he wanted to be an independent artist. And in the 1930s, he turned to the city and the harbor for a lot of his subject matter. His paintings became larger and denser, and he began to layer watercolor much more like an oil painter. He literally would paint with mounted papers on board on an upright easel. So he kind of broke all the rules of watercolor painting at the time. This is actually a scene from downtown Buffalo, which is this beautiful play of light, which is a whole subject unto itself for a presentation on Birchfield. One of the public's favorite paintings by him, by the way. It's in San Diego, and they don't lend it out very often. But music was very, very inspirational to Birchfield. He had a great record collection. He had a wide variety of tastes in music. But he especially liked the work of romantic composers. And sometimes there is a documented direct link between pieces of music and paintings. For example, December Light, painted in 1930 to 31, he wrote on the back literally this, an idea inspired by the second movement of the Sibelius Second Symphony, the opening part. Not an attempt to express the music itself, but an idea that came to me while reflecting on the northern character of the whole symphony. So you have this man versus nature. I have to confess to you, when I first saw this painting that we own at the museum, I thought, oh, how kitschy, the swans, give me a break. You know, it just wasn't this, didn't have the same quality as a lot of the other paintings that I was familiar with. But it's really grown on me over the years because you have this this really terrible critique of what humans have done with killing animals, and this looks probably like a wasp nest, and they've killed these trees to make this stark bridge or whatever it is, and it overlooks, and you can't tell here, but the beautiful silvery light of this imaginary landscape in the background, which of course has birch trees in it, which to me are his Alfred Hitchcock kind of touch of putting himself in his painting. And the swans, and part of my disliking this painting originally may have been because I wasn't so familiar with Sibelius, and when I read this, it was like, oh, I had to go out and listen to Sibelius' Second Symphony for the first time and learn more about Sibelius, and he wrote a tone poem called The Swan of Tuonela, and Tuonela is literally the Finnish hell, but it is a kind of afterlife, and I think some of that is filtering into this painting as well. So here you have music, this literal representation of the tone of the music or the meaning of it. So we know that Birchfield had done away with the audio cryptograms after being in the army, but they come back in the mid-1940s when he's reviewing, literally in 1943, World War II, we're in the midst of crisis, he's not selling any paintings, he's 50 years old, and he decides, I don't care, I'm going to paint what is meaningful to me. And he was an inveterate compiler of, he never destroyed much artwork at all. In fact, we got 25,000 studies in 2008 from the Birchfield Foundation, which are just in this incredible treasure trove. But in 1943, going back through these early works from 1917, he came up with this idea of taking the original painting and mounting it on board, and instead of just painting something new from scratch, mount paper all around it and expand the composition from this new, mature perspective. So one of those paintings is this one, Autumnal Fantasy, started in 1916-17, but not completed until 1943. And this is just such a wonderful representation of the sound of the nuthatches going back and forth and echoing through the knots of the tree, and you have this incredible fantasy landscape and this oak leaf which is twirling down and hitting the water and sound waves reverberating from this. You'll see this often in Birchfield, this eclipsed sun in what he called, you know, for Christians it looks like a cross, but he always referred to it as the diamond sun or the diamond star. So for him, he had been gone from being raised as a Methodist to being pretty much an atheist to an agnostic, and later in the 40s, he joins his wife's church. So he goes through this whole spiritual machinations over the course of his life, but that's one of the symbols that he was much more of a pantheist, and I think that's what resonates the most from his work. Another one of these great sound paintings is the Song of the Telegraph. So you have the song, the crows that are flying across the sky so that even the clouds resonate with their song. You have the telegraph pole where he'd put his ear up to it and the wood would be vibrating. You have the wind harp. Not only are the telegraph vibrations going through the wires, but the wind is blowing it. And if any of you have ever heard Aeolian harp music, it is just stunning. There are people who make these great harps and put them outdoors, and the wind going through them creates the most beautiful sound. And then he contrasts it with this little saccharine, I guess I would call it, bluebird, this beautiful little song. Bluebird used to be the state bird of New York. And against this strange fantasy orchard that has these lynx eyes and these scary kind of interior. So Song of the Telegraph, one of these wonderful vibrating wires that illustrate his return to a form of synesthetic representation, portraying sound with patterns. Associated with childhood memories, the imagery shifts frequently between the realms of the visual and the auditory. Birchfield said, "There are few sounds that are as wild and elemental as the music of the telegraph wires that stir the blood as much and fill the listener, boy or man, with such vague but intense yearning for he knows not what." His audio cryptograms almost exclusively appear as black linear patterns within compositions that reflect a natural palette, color palette, appropriate to the particular season. Since the audio cryptograms are not varied across the color spectrum as are truly synesthetic, sonic-induced color tonalities, they might be interpreted more accurately as interpretive sound waves. I first suggested a connection between Birchfield and synesthesia in 1993 in the Artist as Visionary chapter of my book, The Sacred Woods, that went with a traveling exhibition. I'd prefaced my remarks by saying that Birchfield does not mention ever reading Vasily Kandinsky's 1912 essay on the spiritual in art, but he shared similar thoughts on the role of the artist. I'd already discussed Birchfield's youthful apostasy, his highly inventive conventions for abstract thoughts, his alignment with pantheist principles, and his growing orientation to romanticism in both painting, with particular parallels to the German painter Caspar David Friedrich, and musical preferences. Another artwork related to music was his Song of the Peter Bird. This little study from 1918 shows a transcription of notes in this frilly little motif. And in the original 1918 painting, which wasn't very large, he again made one of these composite paintings and turned it into Sun and Rocks. Now, the Peter Bird was originally on this branch, and it's totally erased, except if you could look really closely, you can see the black of its eye still behind. And it, too, has the solar eclipse in the sky, in the diamond star. And the painting for him was supposed to be conveying the sense of power and tragedy and this primordial grandness that he heard in the Fifth Symphonies of Beethoven and Sibelius. He thought of giants tossing around boulders, and it also can be read as a kind of Christian spiritual painting with a cloud that is like a dove. You have this hawk, or just undescribed bird, this strange black bird going over the horizon. But he writes quite a bit about this pure primordial landscape in the distance. In an autobiographical text, Birchfield wrote, "Since 1956, my work has tended more and more toward the abstract, a term not to be confused with the school that has that title. The abstractness of my recent work is arrived at through the distillation of natural formations or moods into symbols, an idea aimed at in 1915 and arrived at through a long period of conscious experimental attempts at conventionalization. Every so often, when a new idea for a manner of working comes to me, I have the feeling that I am just learning how to paint. It is as if there is a veil between me and the ultimate in painting, and only bit by bit am I allowed to penetrate the mystery beyond that veil." Having experimented with these stylistic devices earlier in his career, Birchfield felt confident using abstraction more boldly in certain later works. For example, The Moth and the Thunderclap from 1961 amplified the structure of motifs in one of his 1920 paintings called Lightning and Thunder at Night. And this is one of those rare times with he didn't embed the original painting in it, but he built off of the structure of the original composition. This is probably his most abstract painting of his career. Alternating jagged cuts fill the sky with synesthetic motifs for the booming claps of thunder that are inescapable from accompanying bolts of lightning. An oddly lyrical set of waves set in the core of a white flash of light signals the blinding and ear-piercing collision of the storm directly overhead. The imagery, the artist said, derived from, quote, the memory of an incident that took place almost 60 years ago, but which seems still as vivid in my memory as the day it happened long ago. These indelible images also suggest a synesthetic tendency to associate particular patterns in color with sounds that are simultaneously experienced. And he also realized as he was working on this painting that his audience might be resistant to the level of abstraction in it, and he was wandering out in his yard at night and he came across a cecropia moth and he thought, that's it, I need this more realistic focal point and then have this kind of chaos around it so there's a way into the painting for the public. And he plays a lot with scale. The cecropia moth, which is pretty large moth, is actually painted larger than life in the painting. Here I'm going to tell you, I'm going to diverge for just a second to tell you a kind of funny anecdote that has to do with the cecropia moth. And that was, we have all kinds of things that were in Birchfield's studio, which includes some of the models. He actually has a dried cecropia moth sample. And I was working in the archives, and one of our staff members, the registrar, came across it for the first time. She said, oh, what is this? And I said, oh, that was Birchfield's cecropia moth. Well, later that night, I went over to my friend's house, and I left about 9 o'clock at night, and it's summer and very warm, and we walked out on the front step. I looked up in the sky, and I saw this moth. And it came closer and closer. And it landed on my cheek. It was a cecropia moth. And I'm not making this up. And it stayed there for about 30 seconds, and then it flew off. And I thought, oh, I don't really believe in reincarnation, but this is an incredible coincidence. That's my cecropia moth, sorry. So when Birchfield's conventions for abstract thoughts and audio cryptograms reemerged in the 1940s and 50s, they came in different guises and filtered through the artist's work for the remainder of his life. Consider, for example, Song of the Tree Cricket, painted 5960. Its motifs include highly patterned abstractions that focus on the invisible tree crickets chirping within a lush design of leaf clusters and twisting willow branches. The tree cricket is only about an inch long. It's very tiny and green, and if you go out at night, you would probably never see it, but he's created these shapes to signify its sound. Its motifs include the highly patterned abstractions that focus on the invisible tree crickets chirping within, oh, I said this, a lush design of leaf clusters and twisting willow branches, a pitch black sky with twinkling stars and mysterious pink-tinged, downturned crescents fill spaces among leaves. In 1917, an upturned curve had been the primary form in morbid brooding, fear, and fascination of evil. Here, it is less malevolent and multiplied, as if derived from the pattern seen in the moon, moths, and plants. In a 1959 letter to friends, Birchfield explained that the crescent shape differs in meaning, of course, according to its position. An upturned crescent, variation like an M, I feel is eerie or menacing, at best a pixie mischievousness. A downward crescent can express astonishment, wariness, foreboding, and also sadness, nostalgia, or worship of God, as in the picture with a cicada church tower, heat, and its discomfort. That much of my work is self-conscious, but how and when they are to be used is more or less spontaneous, unplanned, and intruding on their own power. Song of the Tree Cricket is successful in conveying an ordinary black backyard scene, made extraordinary when sounds can be seen and sensations implied, intruding on their own power to influence how the scene should be perceived. So do these examples illustrate synesthesia? When I asked the artist's son, Charles Arthur Birchfield, whether he thought his father had been synesthetic, he adamantly said no. Clearly, his father never spoke about having synesthetic experiences. However, a few of Birchfield's journal entries raise questions about how he associated color and sound. When he was 22 years old, Birchfield wrote, "Yesterday morning, while on my way to school in the rain, I marked the color of autumn seems to have come all at once. Walking under the trees, I felt as if the color made sound." Such a synesthetic concept may have been a single incident, or there may have been others that were never recounted, such as this entry at age 45. "The other day, my Ekman book on Sibelius came. I find it interesting in many ways. It has a fine portrait of him on the front. I find a few parallels in our careers. He lost his father at 2.5, I at 4, though he was really 5. I don't know why I said 4. He was deeply interested in nature lore as a boy and collected butterflies, etc. Interesting to know is that as a young man, he saw tones in terms of colors." The idea of associating particular composers with colors also appears in comments Birchfield made about Mozart. When Laverne George interviewed him in 1955, she noted that he said he loves yellow. "Here's opening of Mozart's Paris Symphony as pure yellow notes. Loves to play it in the morning." This is borne out further in Birchfield's comments about making special record jackets for his collection, saying, "In the studio, made 2 record albums for Mozart, made the backs yellow because it seems to me his music is symbolized by that color. I plan to make every major composer a different color." Unfortunately, he'd never left us a cue as to what was what, and none of the albums that were given to us by his children have those colors on them, so this will be a big mystery for us. These associations between visual and auditory experiences may not have manifested themselves as distinctly as reports by self-identified synesthetes, but they do suggest an underlying identification of color with music, one of the best recognized attributes. Certainly, Birchfield's symbolic symbols systems conveyed observations, abstract concepts, and physical sensations. Birchfield's eligibility as a potential yet undeclared synesthete was put forward when his work was selected for the exhibition Synesthesia Art in the Mind at McMaster. The other artists that were included in that exhibition included David Hockney, Kandinsky, Joan Mitchell, Marcia Smilak, Carol Steen, Tom Thompson, and Vincent van Gogh. Widely divergent approaches dating from 1885 to 2007 were shown, quote, "to compare these artists' use of formal elements and explore the subject using the shared characteristics shown in the studies of Kluver and Anschutz." The curators selected drawings and paintings that they believe could be used to understand visual commonalities in the works of both acknowledged synesthetic artists and artists who might have been synesthetic, but who either didn't know or didn't speak about it openly. As I mentioned earlier, the workshop brought together the arts and sciences, and a panel of scientists comprised by Daphne Maurer, Edward Hubbard, and Jamie Ward provided an introduction to their studies of the human brain and synesthesia, with an emphasis on the perception of color and form. Art historians and synesthetic artists presented compelling arguments for the recognition of synesthetic perceptions in the work of Tom Thompson, Marcia Smilak, Joan Mitchell, Birchfield, Edward Manet, and Edvard Munch. In my presentation of images and accompanying catalog essay, I posed the question, was Birchfield synesthetic? And that audience responded, resolutely in the affirmative. So, have I imposed a synesthetic label on an artist who simply kept himself open to different sensations? Could his paintings and his writings be defined as purely metaphoric, filled with original symbols of a rich imagination? Does memories cross into the neurological realm that triggered synesthetic perceptions? Certainly, he intended viewers to share his experiences with visceral and emotional empathy. Utilizing color and form, he could make you feel the sun's warmth or the wind's bite. Using audio cryptograms, he wanted you to hear nature, not just to see it. For example, even here you see the snowy owl and the blue jay and these imaginary portals into that mystic north that I was talking about. Now there's proof that Birchfield wanted you to experience even more. An untitled painting known as Bee Hepaticas, which draws on this early convention for nostalgia, illustrates the invisible sense of smell. In 1917, Birchfield wrote about memory of a dream from childhood of hepaticas growing in a strange, gloomy hollow, which led back to a black void in which there were masses of ice. So that very early memory seems to be taking shape here. But I was puzzled by the title for this painting because, number one, there's no such thing as bee hepaticas. Hepaticas are this beautiful, fragile and fragrant flower, one of the first to emerge from the oak leaves in woods in the spring. But it had nothing to do with bee, and it took me some while to find out that even though this was on a flap, because it's technically a not quite finished painting, there was a flap covering it that said bee hepaticas. That's because it was painted on bee watercolor paper, so that if Birchfield was going to make any additions, he would want the paper to be the same kind so that any changes would not be discernible. And then there were some other clues. There's the significance of the hepaticas, which was his most beloved spring flower, and he associated it with his love for his mother and his wife, Bertha. And under this wonderful golden floral archway in the form of nostalgia, the blossoms emerge from this thick carpet of leaves, and winter retreats in the guise of a snowy owl flying into a black abyss beyond a stand of birch trees. This startling contrast between eerie darkness and fairy tale beauty is enhanced by dappled light scintillating around the scene. Birchfield's hepaticas perfume the painting, acting as sentinels warding off the unknown that lurks down the receding shadowed path in this season transition. But then in those studies that were given to us, I found a folder that was titled The Fragrance of Spring, and it contained two studies that clearly were for this painting. And it proved that he was attempting to illustrate the scent with a cascade of diffused hepatica blossoms surrounding the vignette and wavy lines in the leafy ground noted to be the decayed leaf odors. So hence the fragrance of spring was created to convey universally shared sensibilities. Birchfield filtered through his uniquely conceived conventions, audio cryptograms, symbols, and strategically placed colors. His multi-sensory paintings not only appeal to sight, but also arouse auditory, tactile, and aromatic sensations. He sought inspiration in nature, music, and literature, and shared his insights with the confidence of one who lives apart from the rest. There is no doubt that Birchfield's sensitivity to his surroundings inspired dynamic paintings. He created a consciously articulated visual language of expression, yet it is also plausible that his sensuous painting derived from a special understanding allied with synesthetic perception. Thank you.